acting Homeland Security Secretary, less than 2 weeks before the department will help coordinate security for Joe Biden's inauguration amid heightened threats of violence and protests. As a last act, Chad Wolf announced that he had authorized the U.S. Secret Service to begin enhanced security operations on 13th of January, nearly a full week before the inauguration ceremony. In light of the events of the past week and the evolving security landscape leading up to the inauguration. Before the riots, the Secret Service was due to begin implementing special security measures on the day before the inauguration on 19th of January. During his time in office, Chad Wolf was among the president's most loyal lieutenants, eagerly stepping into the spotlight to defend the administration's actions before Congress and on cable news. This summer, he became the public face of the administration's crackdown on protesters in the wake of nationwide demonstrations against police brutality and racism. Chad Wolf's decision to deploy tactical agents to detain protesters in Portland, Oregon, sparked national backlash and criticism that he was bending the department to Donald Trump's political agenda. Chad Wolf's resignation comes hours before Donald Trump is due to visit Alamo, Texas, where he will survey progress on the U.S.-Mexico border wall. I leave knowing that the Department of Homeland Security has positioned itself for an orderly and smooth transition to President-elect Joe Biden's DHS team, he wrote. Welcome them, educate them, and learn from them. They are your leaders for the next 4 years, a time which undoubtedly will be full of challenges and opportunities to show the American public the value of the Department of Homeland Security and why it is worth the investment.
On Friday, the United States imposed sanctions on chairman of Iraq's popular mobilization unit, Faleh al-Fayyad, accusing him of human rights abuses during anti-government demonstrations in the Arab country in late 2019. Iraq's foreign ministry slammed as unacceptable the U.S. Treasury Department's blacklisting of the 64-year-old. The ministry said it will carefully pursue all decisions made by the Treasury against Iraqi figures during both the current and the incoming U.S. administrations and will attempt to address the ramifications. Meanwhile, the leader of the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq also issued a statement strongly denouncing the new U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of his country's sovereignty. The move also drew condemnations from Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movements. In a statement, Hezbollah said the new sanctions are the latest entry in the list of U.S. crimes against the Iraqi government and people, while Ansarullah deemed the sanctions as another sign of Washington's animosity toward the Arab nation.
So when the United States now sees that the Ashkal Sha'abi, the popular mobilization forces in Iraq, are, even though they are led by an established politician, a well-respected political leader with a long state of service that is now the chairman of the Ashkal Sha'abi, despite all of this, the United States will still consider this person to be a potential threat. However, from the perspective of the United States, the U.S. imperialist perspective, the Ashkal Sha'abi presents a domestic and a homegrown, purely Iraqi domestic resistance against terrorism, but also against imperialism, against foreign hegemony, and against, you know, attempts to overtake the country and to make Iraq into a puppet state, as it sort of was in the first few years after the 2003 invasion.
The Ansarullah movement voiced confidence that the sanctions would not affect the Iraqi people's will to free their homeland and drive the occupying forces out of their country. The PMU celebrated its leader being hit by U.S. sanctions, saying it's an honor for the Iraqi official to be viewed as one of Washington's enemies, alongside Iran and Iraq's top commanders who were assassinated in a drone strike ordered by President Donald Trump. The PMU was formed by popular volunteer forces in 2014 after the Daesh terror group launched a campaign of bloodshed and destruction against Iraq. The group played a major role in pushing back and ultimately defeating the terrorist forces, which had taken control of large swathes of the Arab country. The Iraqi parliament voted to integrate the PMU into the Iraqi military in 2016, effectively placing the force under the command of Prime Minister and granting the group a standing similar to that of other branches of Iraqi security forces. But even that hasn't kept the U.S. from putting extra pressure on the group, similar to any other forces that stand against Washington's hegemony in the region.
Indeed, despite the fact that the United States, they talk a lot about the war on terror ever since the Bush era, but in reality we have seen that the United States arms and supports terrorist organizations all over the globe. This goes from Colombian drug lords to Salafi, Wahhabi, Takfiri gangs in Iraq, to ethnic supremacists trying to break apart the nations of Iran and Pakistan, for example. This is a global campaign of support to real terrorists, and at the same time, a campaign of targeting, assassinating, and attacking, slandering, and trying to imprison people who actually fight against these terrorists.
But the U.S. actions against the resistance in the region are provoking the correspondent reactions. Anti-U.S. sentiment in West Asia is on the rise, with more people calling for the ouster of U.S. from West Asia by the day.
What the world saw on Wednesday with pro-Trump mobs storming the U.S. Capitol was the peak of a year of white nationalist and anti-democratic violence across the U.S., violence that steadily intensified and featured the direct incitements of the U.S. president. Last February, the FBI issued a report to Congress warning that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists had become the primary source of domestic terrorist threats and killings. In the past couple of years, white supremacist groups have been causing violence and disruption in the U.S. They're often blamed for growing instances of hate crime and aggravated harassment in the country. Many people have linked this type of violence to the inflammatory rhetoric that the U.S. president used in his speeches. In fact, Trump's constant siding with white supremacist groups, who often disrupt protests and rallies carrying semi-automatic rifles, alarmed many of an eruption of a possible conflict in the country. And on January 6th, that conflict happened. Trump has been accused of inciting a mob of supporters to stage an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. 5 people have died, dozens have gotten arrested, and Bipartisan is outraged.
It's an extraordinary situation that we've seen in Washington. And when you look at the numbers of people who were rioters who worked their way into the Capitol, this is incredibly dangerous. In fact, we've never really seen anything like this, certainly not in my lifetime. And this isn't just Donald Trump. There were those who supported him, but clearly by the thousands, what we saw were right-wing extremists, we saw racist groups, we saw others who are all part of this rioting process. And when you look at the buildup over the last 4 years, this isn't particularly shocking.
People now believe that Donald Trump and every politician who promoted the falsehood that the November election was stolen bear tremendous responsibility for riling the supporters who disrupted the counting of the Electoral College vote confirmation. After what happened in the U.S. Capitol, many politicians called for Trump's removal from office before Biden's inauguration. They said that Trump's final days as U.S. president pose a grave national security threat and warrant his immediate removal from office. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the U.S.
He's not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying that his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said that she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave the Oval Office voluntarily.
It's difficult to remove a sitting president. You have the possibility of the 25th Amendment, but the 25th Amendment requires the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. And even then, if the president refuses, you then have to take it to Congress. That's hard. There's only a few days left in Trump's presidency. The other option is impeachment. That too is politically complicated and it takes time. And so it's difficult to do it very, very quickly. But I think it highlights something bigger, something more broad. And that's that the fact that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, actually went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The fact that it was the vice president who was working his way around the president, actually excluding the president from the chain of command, is something simply unprecedented. So it really highlights just how dangerous this actually is, and I think the realities of the difficulty of removing a sitting president.
It's not just the Democrats who seek to remove Trump. Republicans are also calling for his impeachment. They say what Trump did on Wednesday can happen any other time. He has already said that he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. But there's still a possibility that he can call another 50,000 people to Washington and create another deadly chaos. Many believe that the U.S. president can even do worse and launch nuclear war on his way out of the White House. That is why officials are trying to close every possible door to chaos. The U.S. president's prized Twitter account has been permanently suspended, and Facebook and Instagram have banned him indefinitely. In the meantime, Pelosi talked to the head of the U.S. military, seeking available precautions for preventing Trump from initiating military hostilities or accessing the launch codes. But although Trump's political power is draining away, his cult of personality still commands tremendous loyalty among his Make America Great Again fan base. That's the reason behind a recent joint statement from all 10 living former U.S. defense secretaries, in which they warned against the military interfering in a peaceful transfer of power.
When one considers how the United States portrays itself in the media and in folklore, it's easy to be fooled into thinking that the streets are paved with gold and everything is bigger and better in the U.S. However, recent events have clearly shown that the country is flawed to the core. It's hence why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has questioned just where this utopian image of the United States has gone, as he stated that today we can see what this big idol has turned into. The leader went on to question the rationale of those who still worship the United States, clearly suggesting that some are blinded by ignorance as they fail to see events unfolding before them in Washington and other major U.S. towns and cities across America. Speaking on the economy, the leader also noted the crippling effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States, with the world's highest death rate and numbers reflecting a huge slump in finances, with many people losing their jobs and businesses collapsing due to a lack of positive action by the U.S. government. But the most valid point of all was the leader's analysis on the recent election that took place in the US, not focusing on the result, but on the process and aftermath, with the leader labelling the whole election as a fiasco, sparked of course by the outrageous actions by the outgoing president Donald Trump for inciting violence. In truth, Ayatollah Khamenei had been quoting similar views long before the arrival of the COVID-19 virus, the collapse of the US economy, and of course the disgusting behaviour demonstrated by Trump and his droogs. So did the leader have a point when he delivered his observations this time round?
He does have a point, because I think what people aren't recognising when they see the US from the outside is that it's going through a fundamental decline. That's hard to believe, and the decline is often not easily, if you like, recognisable. But let me just give you a few indicators. Since 2008, the United States has gone into a 200% increase, a surge in its national debt. $27 trillion is the current United States debt. That's, you know, 200% increase, as I say, over the last 10 or so years.
With the imminent departure of Donald Trump, the arrival of a US president has left some people feeling optimistic of change, both in America and around the world. Many have questioned the notion of the US and Iran reconciling sometime in the near future under the presidency of Joe Biden. However, with the leader stating that some feel if this happens, Iran will become a paradise, will a relationship with the Americans genuinely benefit Iran?
Well, I think that, I points to this idea of people who may think that a deal with America will in some way give economic benefits to Iran overnight. This is not going to be the case. You know, the deals that the Iranians will have to do in order to really stand any chance of any kind of collaboration from America are going to be morally impossible for Iran to go ahead with.
But the truth of the matter is, Iran's in no rush to reach out the hand of friendship to the US, with the Americans imposing sanctions on Iran, as well as assassinating Iran's chief counterterrorism commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. It's also why Iran are not waiting for a knock on the door from America to rejoin the JCPOA. With Iran proving itself to be a successfully self-sufficient nation, as well as showing the world that it was and still is more than able to stand up and defeat the American maximum pressure policy, it's no wonder that Iran can stand tall, proud, and confident in its rhetoric. With an abundance of natural resources, four seasons that gift Iran with a fertile and beautiful land, and of course a culture spanning back 5,000 years, it seems that Iran has a lot to be proud of and is already a slice of paradise.
The United States is still reeling from what happened at the heart of the American democracy in the capital of the nation on Wednesday. The unprecedented chaos in Washington, D.C. has been described by many as a shattering blow to the image of America. The extent of polarization of the American society was on full display on Wednesday. Supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump, encouraged by him, marched to the Capitol building as the Congress was meeting to confirm Joe Biden's election victory. Chaotic scenes erupted as Trump supporters clashed with security forces and stormed the Capitol building. The violent mayhem temporarily blocked the counting of the Electoral College votes. Several people lost their lives inside and outside the Congress building. Trump, who has repeated claims of a stolen election, was widely condemned for inciting violence in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday.
What led to this one has been, in terms of its most recent context, 4 years of Donald Trump and Donald Trump lying to the American people about a number of things, but most recently lying to the American people about the election and the fact that that he won in his mind.
The storming of the Capitol building triggered a number of resignations from Trump's team less than 2 weeks before the outgoing president's term will be over. Meanwhile, senior Democrats are calling for Trump to be removed immediately. They want him to be forced out of office now, either under the disability clause of the 25th Amendment or through an impeachment. 4 years of Trump's divisive presidency seems to have fueled different divisions in the American society to an unprecedented level. The unprecedented violence in Washington, D.C. will undoubtedly be hard for America to recover from. Soon after the storming of the Capitol building by his supporters, Trump committed to an orderly transition of power later this month. But the damage is done. The bitter developments of this week seem to have hugely dented the credibility of America's democracy. Meanwhile, Wednesday's events in Washington drew reactions from around the world. Some countries went so far as to say that the chaos exposed internal collapse in the American political system, and that the event showed Western democracy is fragile and broken.
America has been championing this fraud that America is the, as Ronald Reagan said, the shining city on the hill, and profess to be the bastion of democracy. But the best way that America seems to be able to bring democracy to other places is at the barrel of a gun. And so What I honestly believe that this has done is it has exposed the hypocrisy of America.
American officials have long lectured the leaders of other countries on democratic values and peaceful transfer of power from one elected president to another. Americans have been very proud of peaceful and smooth handover of government every 4 years. But that did not happen this time. Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections. One recent opinion poll shows more than half of Republican voters believe Trump rightfully won the election. That's tens of millions of Americans that don't trust the election result. The incoming administration of Joe Biden will face many domestic and foreign challenges. But right now, perhaps leading a divided America will probably be the toughest task facing the future president of the United States.
Defend the Constitution.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Trump could be charged with solicitation to commit a crime of violence, that is murder, under 18 U.S.C. Sect 373. It is a crime to solicit, command, induce, or endeavor to persuade another person to commit a felony involving the threat or use of physical force. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Marjorie Kahn Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump can be indicted under federal, state, and DC laws for his role in January 6th. Here's the details. The legal evidence is damning. Donald Trump should be held criminally liable for seditious conspiracy and inciting insurrection for his role in stoking the events of January 6th, when an angry mob of Trump loyalists, incited by the president himself, stormed the Capitol building to stop the congressional counting of voters for Joe Biden in the Electoral College. The mob easily breached the Capitol building, rampaged through the halls of Congress, some waving Confederate flags, terrorizing senators and Congress members. In stark contrast to the overwhelming and violent police force used against the largely peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters, there was little resistance offered by law enforcement against Trump's mostly white minions as they entered the building where Congress was meeting and tore it apart. Trump's violent backers did temporarily hold the count of votes for Biden. Five people died, and the mob of Trump supporters sprayed chemicals through lead pipes and injured more than 50 officers. Hours later, Trump released a videotaped message praising them. "We love you. You're very special." He gave them permission to go home. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is right to be pursuing efforts to remove Trump from the presidency through the 25th Amendment, but that effort hit a roadblock today as House Republicans refused to give unanimous consent to a resolution urging Vice President Mike Pence to initiate the process. That means the House will vote on the resolution, which is expected to pass easily. Even if, as expected, Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment procedure, Democrats can still press ahead with efforts to impeach and convict Trump, so as to bar him from holding future federal office. In the weeks that follow, Trump may also be charged with the commission of several federal and even state crimes. After January 20th, Trump will no longer be shielded by the Department of Justice policy that a sitting president cannot be indicted. There is overwhelming evidence that Trump committed several crimes. The Constitution gives the president pardon power but says nothing about self-pardons. Trump has discussed pardoning himself. Since no president has ever done that, it is not clear whether a self-pardon would withstand a legal challenge if the Biden administration were to mount one. In any event, Trump does not have the power to pardon state crimes. Thus, wherever possible, federal cases should be filed jointly with prosecutions under D.C. law and laws in states such as Virginia and Maryland, where many Trump loyalists stayed, and in their home states as well. Trump violated 18 U.S.C. Sect. 2383, which prohibits incitement of rebellion or insurrection. It provides for 10 years in prison for anyone who incites any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States or the laws thereof, or gives aid or comfort thereto. If convicted of this crime, Trump shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. The evidence cited in the pending article of impeachment also supports the criminal charge of inciting rebellion or insurrection against Trump. Trump also committed seditious conspiracy in violation of 18 U.S.C. Sect. 2384, but conspiring to oppose by force the authority of the government and by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States. Seditious conspiracy carries a 20-year prison sentence. Interrupting the counting of the electoral votes constitutes delaying the execution of U.S. law. During the January 6th siege, Rudy Giuliani left a long voicemail meant for Senator Tommy Tuberville, urging him to slow down the vote certification in the Electoral College. it reached Senator Mike Lee instead. In a 10-minute phone conversation with Tuberville, Trump implored him to make additional objections to the vote count. Trump apparently resisted calling in the National Guard, which ultimately arrived once the Capitol breach was well underway. Trump loyalists quickly found the offices of specific legislators, including Nancy Pelosi. They went directly to Representative James Clyburn's private office, which few people knew about that, leading Michael Moore to speculate that congresspersons were on the conspiracy. Giuliani, Donald Trump Jr., and Representative Mo Brooks, together with Trump, conspired to exhort the large crowd to stop the counting of votes in the Electoral College, which is a U.S. law contained in the Constitution. Over a period of several weeks, people close to Trump encouraged and advertised the wild January 6th event. Moreover, White House counsel Pat Cipollone told White House officials not to talk to Trump or assist his coup attempt, so they would not be prosecuted for treason. Trump could also be charged with solicitation to commit a crime of violence, that is murder, under 18 U.S.C. Sect 373. It is a crime to solicit, command, induce, or endeavor to persuade another person to commit a felony involving the threat or use of physical force. If prosecutors can prove that whomever killed Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick was incited to violence at the rally where Trump exhorted his followers, he could be convicted of inciting murder. Legal grounds also exist for charging Trump in Georgia for having solicited Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to commit election fraud. In a January 2nd phone call, Trump bullied the Georgia Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes to overturn Biden's win in that state and threatened Raffensperger if he didn't comply. Trump can be charged with criminal solicitation to commit election fraud in Georgia state court. For months before the presidential election, Trump spewed false claims of fraud to preemptively discredit a Biden victory, both before and after Biden won 306 electoral votes, far more than 270 required to win. Trump filed frivolous lawsuits challenging their results. Judge after judge dismissed them, and the Supreme Court refused to overturn the election. Trump pressured election officials in several states to refuse to certify duly chosen Biden electors. And he sought to disenfranchise people of color in targeted countries and jurisdictions with primarily black or brown populations. For weeks, White House staff and Trump's close allies planned and promoted the Stop the Steal protest on January 6th at the Capitol. Big protest in D.C. on January 6th, Trump tweeted on December 19th, "Be there, we'll be wild." Since Pence would be presiding over the joint session of Congress on January 6th, Trump applied tremendous pressure on him to stop the certification of Biden's electoral votes. When Pence told Trump that the Constitution gave him no such power, Trump was furious. On January 6th, Trump and his co-conspirators Giuliani, Trump Jr., and Brooks egged on the assembled crowd, urging them to march to the Capitol and stop the constitutionally mandated electoral vote count. Giuliani told the throng, "Let's have trial but combat." Trump Jr. yelled, "Stand up and fight," and threatened congressional Republicans who were not trying to overturn the election, declaring, "We are coming for you." Brooks said, "Today is the day American patriots start taking down names," adding, "Our ancestors sacrificed their blood, their sweat, their tears, their fortunes, and sometimes their lives to give us their descendants, an America that is the greatest nation in the world history. He then asked the audience if they were willing to do the same. When Trump addressed the crowd, he called the election outcome this egregious assault on U.S. democracy. He said they would stop the steal and keep the Democrats from fraudulently taking over our country. Trump advised his supporters to show strength and walk down to the Capitol, adding, "You will never take back our country with weakness." He said, "When you catch somebody in a fraud, you are allowed to go by very different rules." They followed Trump's extortion and carried out the most destructive attack on Congress and the process of democratic elections in the U.S. history. Trump's seditious conduct should result in his removal from office under the 25th Amendment, and barring that, he should be impeached. Introduced by Democratic Representatives David Cicilline, Ted Leo, and Jamie Raskin, the article alleges that Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by willfully inciting violence against the government of the United States. Shortly before the Senate and House of Representatives met to count the Electoral College votes, Trump reiterated false claims to a nearby crowd of his supporters, telling them, "We won this election, and we won it by a landslide." The article says Trump also willfully made statements that encouraged and foreseeably resulted in imminent lawless action at the Capitol. The allegations continue. In addition, the article cites Trump's prior efforts to subvert and obstruct the certification of the results of the 2020 presidential election. They include his January 2nd phone call to Raffensperger, during which Trump urged him to find enough votes to overturn Georgia presidential election results and threatened Raffensperger if he failed to do so. The article states that Trump gravely endangered the security of the United States and its government institutions, threatened the integrity of the democratic system, interfered with the peaceful transition of power, and imperiled a coordinate branch of government. Trump thereby betrayed his trust as president to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Finally, the article says, Trump will remain a threat to national security, democracy, and the Constitution if he continues in office. One way or another, Trump should be removed from office and prevented from running for president again in 2024. He must be criminally charged to ensure accountability and prevent impunity for his egregious crimes to deter future presidential lawbreaking.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back to News. I'm your host, Saeed Pourreza, in London, and we'll kick off this broadcast with news about Press TV. Without any warning or explanation, U.S. tech giant Facebook disabled Press TV's account with nearly 4 million followers for nearly 24 hours. The page was reinstated after an appeal, despite the Western media giant saying earlier its decision was final. When quizzed, Facebook declined to give any further explanation for, quote, safety and security concerns. The move comes only months after YouTube blocked Press TV's account for the sixth time on its video sharing page and on Gmail, citing violation of export rules. The Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, which runs Press TV, has called such moves clear examples of pro-U.S. interest censorship and an attack on free speech. All right, let's get more thoughts on this. Joining me now, Mohsen Abbas, a political commentator. Mohsen, good to have you with us. What do you make of it all, this move by Facebook?
Well, it's all steadily in line with what's been happening for many, many years now. What we've got is capitalist totalitarianism emerging more and more. Obviously, surveillance capitalism is a term that we're all quite familiar with, which goes hand in glove with this. Of course, there have been mixed messages. Zuckerberg resisted for a while on Facebook. I mean, he claimed that it was not up to Facebook to police political speech, yet here he is doing exactly that. As the heat's gone up on these corporate institutions, so they are wilting and obviously working in tandem with other political interests. Let me just give you an example. Amy Palmor, the former Director General of Israel's Justice Department, was appointed on the Facebook Oversight Board. That gives you an indication of the kind of influence that Facebook, or the pressure Facebook must be under now, because she was on record chasing Facebook up to sort of ban certain free speech about Israel at that time. So likewise, American political establishment and other forces are at it. They're doing the same thing. They've done this to, of course, Press TV, but also Sputnik and Xinhua, the Chinese and Russian outlets, have been targeted as state media, you know, as if all of Western media has no, you know, partisanship with political and neoliberal ideologies. You know, over 200 pages were initially taken away from these press outlets at the time. Clearly, this is a war against the rising Eurasian, if you like, threat as they see it, and it's part of the maximum.
Let me get your view on this as well. Since it happened, a lot of reaction to the move by Facebook. One person tweeted that this move by Facebook comes ahead of a speech by the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in which he's going to accuse Iran of links to Al-Qaeda. Do you see any relationship in all of this?
Well, absolutely. Of course, you know, the Facebook, the power of these social media outlets is immense. The algorithms are now literally at the stage where they can direct in certain directions. You can't say anything against vaccination. You can't question things around political policies of the West. But of course, there are voices that are now really major voices speaking out against this. Let me give you the example of Tim Berners-Lee, the father of the internet, no less, who gave birth to the World Wide Net. He hates this corporate capitalism that's going on and this kind of totalitarianism on these outlets. In fact, he's hates it so much, he's setting up an alternative. He's actually challenging these major corporations, and he's taking them on with an altogether new system.
And Mohsen, one thanks for that example. One quick question that can be asked is, since when have giant tech companies become the arbiters of what the public is able to consume?
Well, ever since I think that they've basically set us all up for it. Of course, they needed 20 years to hoover up all the information, get us all hooked on there, get a kind of a psychological hold on people. Now, the party's over. I believe that now, increasingly, what you're going to see is that these tech companies are going to be politically maneuvered and forced by not only the states themselves, but also the deeper state. The money mafia in the background will actually make sure these tech giants do as they're told and work in line with the Agenda 2030, for instance, UN has been rolling out, which is all about controlling society, managing it in the interests of the powerful elitists.
All right. Well, the page is back up, and still we'll be able to get the truth out there for people to see. Mohsen Abbas, thank you. To other news now. Across Europe, the number of COVID-19 cases and deaths are soaring. The World Health Organization had predicted the winter months were going to be tough, but with the new variants of the virus making it more transmissible and with lockdown fatigue setting in, experts are urging vigilance. Yanki Rahimi has more in this report.
The COVID-19 pandemic is taking thousands of lives every day, and families everywhere are struggling to find closure. No visitations before loved ones die, and new burial rituals are taking their toll. In parts of Greece, victims are being buried away from their loved ones in separate plots. In Italy and Germany, crematoriums are struggling to cope with the sheer number of grieving families and an overwhelming number of bodies. The dead must be handled with protective clothing and masks, and according to the head of this crematorium, the number of deaths this winter is 20 times any flu wave.
The crematorium is full, as you can see. The caskets are not only stacked one by one, but three times high. Here, in the memorial hall, there are also many deceased stored. We use all the space we have. From the quantity, you can see that there is simply an improbable mortality. Corona is real.
The World Health Organization predicted a tough winter, with the COVID-19 pandemic and flu season overlapping. But experts say this recent surge in cases and deaths is due in part to families mixing.
The number of contacts that individuals had and their families had increased significantly over the Christmas and New Year holiday. And that has had a direct impact on the exponential growth that you have seen in many countries. Some of the exponential growth we've seen in countries is almost vertical.
Several vaccines are now being administered across the globe. In Europe, rollouts got off to a shaky start, but are now picking up pace. In the UK, which was the first in the world to start inoculating the most vulnerable, 2.3 million Britons have already got the jab. But experts say it will take until autumn for everyone to get it.
This is an extremely serious moment for the country. And as good news as the vaccine is, it cannot be seen by any of us as a free pass to ignore the national guidance.
During this, the UK's third lockdown, the police are cracking down on people breaking the rules. The statistics show more people are out and about now than during the previous lockdowns, while hospitals cope with double the number of cases as the new variant of the virus blazes through the population. Yanka Rahimi, London.
In other news of the day, aid agencies in Yemen have warned that the U.S. designation of Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization hinders their desperately needed operations in the war-torn country.
This was already the world's worst humanitarian crisis. It was already a situation where millions of people are struggling to afford food, and food rations have been halved for millions, or famine warnings have just resurfaced. So this is really a life and death matter that we're talking about.
It is more relevant to consider who kills women and children in their homes and seizes the ports and blocks food and medicine as a terrorist.
UN Secretary General's spokesperson, Stefan Dujarric, also warned of serious political and humanitarian consequences. The move bears the hallmarks of an administration keen to make an impact in its final days. It remains unclear if the incoming Biden administration will maintain this designation. Well, for more on this, Robert Carter joins me to give us some analysis of what's happening in Yemen. And Robert, you're in touch with people on the ground in Yemen. What does this 11th hour designation by the Trump administration mean, especially for the people of Yemen?
Thanks, Aid. Well, obviously, a lot of people in Yemen, particularly on the ground there, are concerned, to say the least. Obviously, as everyone knows, Yemen has been a besieged nation for well over 5 years now. The only two ways in which vitally needed food aid is able to get in and out of the country is via the capital's airport, Sana'a, which remains closed to passenger flights, or the port city of Hodeidah, both of which are besieged, both of which are administered by the Houthi Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a. So, of course, this designation means that even any slim way in which people are able to communicate, say, with their families in Yemen, they're going to probably find it very difficult to do so. So just sending money, small amounts of money, into Yemen from, say, the US or Europe could get you in big, big trouble. In fact, you could get a jail sentence for doing so, as you'd be technically sending money to a terrorist-administered zone under this new US designation. So obviously it's been highly condemned, but I think from the actual official response from the Yemeni government is that, you know, the peace process has been failing for a long, long time in Yemen, and ultimately this is just the latest sign that peace talks might not be the way to break the siege. They might have to turn to military solutions in order to try and make that breakthrough.
So you spoke of a peace process. Does this mean that the Americans under this administration said, you know what, we've been supporting the Saudis in the war in Yemen to try and get the Houthis to their feet, probably hand them a defeat? It didn't work. Let's go ahead and designate them as an FTO, as a foreign terrorist organization.
Well, I think that the way the Yemenis see it, at least I can portray that to the best of my ability, is that the Saudis are essentially attack dogs that were given the green light to attack Yemen by Washington. They believe that this is a Washington-led war on Yemen, and they believe that Trump's administration, or his regime, rather, has basically profited from the war as much as it can. Now that the Trump's regime is on the out, they're basically trying to upset what Biden's administration could look to do as much as possible. There is rumors that Biden might look to bring about some kind of meaningful peace in Yemen, and this move by Trump and Pompeo are looking to upset that. But however, Washington Post has reported that apparently Biden's foreign policy team deeply disagree with the move to designate the Ansarullah as a terrorist organization. So many Yemenis are hopeful that Biden will come in and simply reverse Trump's policies, but that has yet to be proven. And quite frankly, after so many years of different U.S. administrations all supporting this war against Yemen and greenlighting Saudi aggression, can we trust Biden?
The role of the UAE, Robert, policies? Should not be forgotten. They contributed like $20 million to the Middle East Institute, you know, with people, former administration officials who direct policy changes perhaps in Washington. Pompeo, the Secretary of State, was spotted with the head of the Mossad, Yossi Cohen, in Washington as early as yesterday. Are we expecting any more Pompeo action before the Biden administration is inaugurated, in your opinion, briefly?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not just in regards to Yemen. They've already made their move to try and get the Ansarullah designated as a terrorist group, which is deeply damaging to the peace process there. But also we're expecting an anti-Iran speech. It's been suspected that Pompeo will try and link Iran to Al-Qaeda, would you believe, despite the fact that Iran's been fighting against Al-Qaeda on many fronts for many years now. So ridiculous claims of that nature will be made. Also, of course, the moves against Cuba and China are also expected and have been pushed ahead so far. So this is a rogue regime that's lashing out on its final days, and unfortunately we're just going to have to put up with it until the oppressive regime that's gripping onto power as long as it can in the US is finally ripped from the halls of the White House. But even then, I think it would be naive of us to hope too much that Biden's simply going to come in and make the world a better place. All U.S. Regimes have proven time and again that they don't tend to honor their promises very much. But let's hope that something will change for Yemen.
It's in the home stretch now, isn't it? Press TV's Robert Carter. Robert, thank you for joining us. And now let's take a look at some other stories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya has accused Israel of racism for denying Palestinians access to the coronavirus vaccine.
We condemn the racism of the occupation state, which boasts about the speed of vaccinating its citizens and neglecting the legal responsibility to provide vaccines to the people under occupation.
20% of the 9 million Israelis living in the occupied territories have gotten the jab so far. The Palestinian Authority has reached agreements with four companies to import vaccines in the next 2 months.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, B'Tselem, a human rights NGO based in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, has called Israel a non-democratic apartheid regime advancing and perpetuating the supremacy of Jews over Palestinians. Well, let's see how that's gone down on Twitter with Rob in Lakesh. Rob, Ed, what can you add to that?
Well, this is a very interesting report which has been filed. B'Tselem is the number one leading human rights organization, which is based in the occupied territories. And also focusing on what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in general. In its report, it stated that Israel is pursuing policies of Jewish supremacy over the native Palestinian population, and it is very specific in that it calls out the occupation of the West Bank, in which approximately 3 million Palestinians live, the illegal besiegement of the unlivable Gaza Strip, declared unlivable by the United Nations, 2 million people living there under siege, East Jerusalem al-Quds under occupation with 350,000 Palestinians living there, and also the undermining of what are known as Arab Israeli citizens, so Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, who are treated lesser than the Jewish citizens of Israel and are discriminated against when it comes to land registration and other services inside of the country. As well. So when we're looking at this report, it's a comprehensive look at what's going on. If you look on the B'Tselem website, they are very meticulous. They are by the letter of the law. They try their best to not make any mistakes legally when they are reporting on this. They report the facts on the ground and have, of course, done this for many years now. So they're a very reputable organization, and this has stoked a lot of anger from Zionists online who are against Israel being called a non-democratic apartheid regime. Also included in this report, they do state that Israel is essentially dominating all of the land between the river and the sea, and hence it is an apartheid regime because Palestinians effectively have no real autonomy. When it comes to the Gaza Strip, Hamas has its leadership there, its government there, but does not have full autonomy over that land. Israel controls it. When it comes to the West Bank as well, the Palestinian Authority has to work in the confines of what Israel dictates it must do. And also, we've just noted what happened when it came to Israel passing on vaccines to Palestinians. It has excluded 5 million Palestinians between the river and the sea from the vaccination process. And also, we know that Israel have been making strides towards annexing the land inside of the West Bank.
It so is, when we're looking at this, it's a pretty significant designation by B'Tselem, is it not, Robert? Bring us some of the online opinion on this issue.
Well, in response to a lot of the Zionist trolls, as they're called online, we've had quite a few pro-Palestinian voices come out and celebrate the fact that this has been declared. The first we have here is from a user called Julia, who says, Israel is an apartheid state, end of story, and it's not anti-Semitic to say so. It's a statement of fact of the way the Israeli regime operates across its territories and with different categories of residents. Also, we have another one here who says that Israel is the last remnant of European colonialist apartheid left to be dismantled, a dangerous racist European experiment that has badly gone wrong. Like all colonialists, they invade, occupy, or steal, and subjugate the countries they invade. The world must stop this.
The world must stop this. Robert in Lakesh with that story for us. Robert, thank you. 3 months after Russia oversaw a ceasefire between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Russian president has met with the two countries' leaders in Moscow to negotiate the next steps in keeping the peace in Nagorno-Karabakh.
I consider today's meeting useful and of utmost importance because we have managed to reach an agreement and we have signed a joint statement on the development of the situation in the region. Today we have made specific steps on building economic ties and developing infrastructure projects.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan hailed the new infrastructure projects but insisted the status of Nagorno-Karabakh was yet to be determined. I could do more with 30 pounds. The words of an angry British mother criticizing inadequate free school meals for children from low-income families in this country. Ahmed Caballo joins me now with the details of that story.